Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, June 3rd, 2013. Day one of the 12-week or longer Bradley Manning court-martial trial. From the record, we know that Bradley Manning is a Lady Gaga fan. He used a CD of hers to cover for some of the material that he was copying when he had access to secret information as part of his military assignment. I don't know if he's an Elvis Costello fan, but as I reviewed the opening testimony from the prosecutors and the defense, this is the song that came to mind. That Bradley Manning was deeply disturbed by what he experienced in Iraq. And it led him to try to shine some light and share with the American people the dark side that he had been exposed to. So the prosecution opened up at Fort Meade, Maryland today. Quote, this is a case about a soldier who systematically harvested hundreds of thousands of classified documents and dumped them onto the internet into the hands of the enemy. Material he knew, based on his training, would put the lives of fellow soldiers at risk. Fascinating that the lead quote in Charlie Savage's New York Times story about the start of this trial is based on a falsehood. There is not a shred of evidence that a single American soldier has been put at risk by the information that was leaked by Bradley Manning. And the rejoinder from defense lawyer David Combs, he was young, he was naive, he was good-intentioned, and in fact he tried to make sure that the several hundred thousand documents he released would not cause harm. He was selective, said Combs. He had access to literally hundreds of millions of documents as an all-source analyst, and these were the documents that he released. And he released these documents because he was hoping to make the world a better place. Now, I can hear the scorn reaction from many Americans who say, oh, Bradley Manning wanted to make the world a better place. But I actually believe it. This trial is expected to go on for at least another 12 weeks. There isn't much dispute because Manning has already conceded by pleading guilty to 10 charges that he did leak government documents. But the government didn't engage in a plea bargain, and the president who has cracked down on leakers twice as often as all presidents before him combined is not easing up on Manning. He wants him jailed for life because the prosecution is trying to convict him under the Espionage Act and for aiding the enemy. And as we look at this situation, in a few minutes I'm going to tell you about a journalist in Yemen who says that Barack Obama is personally responsible for his continuing incarceration. We heard the president at the fundraiser in San Francisco almost 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, it was in April, where he flatly said that Bradley Manning broke the law. We know that they're going to present secret testimony from anonymous individuals that we're told are members of SEAL Team 6 to try to show that Osama bin Laden requested and received some of the WikiLeaks documents attributed to Bradley Manning. And so the government is going to great lengths to make an example of Private Manning and the issue about the leak of this information in an effort to cleanse the United States of the virus of secrecy. 92 million documents were classified as secret last year. And so there's a whole secret universe that exists beyond the control, beyond the knowledge, even of most of our elected leaders. And in the president's speech on May 23rd, I felt that the conflicts, those internal conflicts that he talked about, yes, I've killed innocent civilians with drone strikes, and I have to live with that for the rest of my life. And yet, it's hard to have any sympathy for a president who is, well, first of all, he has held Bradley Manning for 3 years. And the first 18 months of that were cruel, brutal, inhumane incarceration and solitary confinement. So we'll be watching this trial, and later today, I am scheduled to talk with Ray McGovern, the former CIA analyst, who's been front and center in the protests over the weekend. Thousands of people marched in Washington in support of Bradley Manning. Ray was planning to be in the courtroom at Fort Meade, Maryland today, and we expect to talk with him later this afternoon. It'll be about 8 o'clock Eastern time. And if it all works out, I will post that podcast immediately for our subscribers at peterbcollins.com. Now, timed with the start of this important court-martial hearing, a rather unusual op-ed appeared in Sunday's New York Times. It is nominally a book review, a review of a book written by Google's former CEO, Eric Schmidt, and a co-author. And the book review is written by Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks and its editor-in-chief, who wrote this book review from the safety of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, England, where he can't leave because he's wanted on charges in Sweden. He believes that if he faces those charges, he will be extradited to the United States. We know that an investigation by our government is in its third year and has not been closed. His wariness is probably very well founded. And it's an interesting book review he takes on Google's "Don't Be Evil" mantra. Refers to it as the banality of "Don't Be Evil." And he talks about the linkages, the parallels, the common interests of this relatively young startup called Google and the interests of the United States government. And he even was permitted by the Times editors to insert a paragraph about Bradley Manning. Quote, "The Department of Justice admitted in March that it was in its third year of a continuing criminal investigation of WikiLeaks. Court testimony states that its targets include the founders, owners, or managers of WikiLeaks. One alleged source, Bradley Manning, faces a 12-week trial beginning tomorrow, with 24 prosecution witnesses expected to testify in secret." And in his commentary about Eric Schmidt's book, here's this quote from Julian Assange. "The advance of information technology epitomized by Google heralds the death of privacy for most people and shifts the world toward authoritarianism. This is the principal thesis in my book, Cypherpunk. But while Mr. Schmidt and Mr. Cohen tell us that the death of privacy will aid governments in repressive autocracies in targeting their citizens, they also say governments in open democracies will see it as a gift, enabling them to better respond to citizen and customer concerns. In reality, the erosion of individual privacy in the West and the attendant centralization of power make abuses inevitable, moving the good societies closer to the bad ones." Now, completely unconnected from the New York Times piece, in the business section of the San Francisco Chronicle today, a Hearst paper, there's a profile of Eric Schmidt. And for the first time, I learn here about his very deep role in the internet operations of the Obama re-election campaign last year in 2012. Eric Schmidt helped recruit talent, choose technology, and coach the campaign manager, Jim Messina, on the finer points of leading a large organization. On election night, he was in our boiler room in Chicago, says David Plouffe, former campaign advisor to Obama. And the key man in the data manipulation operation is Dan Wagner, a 30-year-old, who is credited with producing Obama's surprising 5 million vote margin of victory. That according to this news story. And now, Eric Schmidt, because he's a Google millionaire or billionaire, I have lost track, he has hired Dan Wagner and his team. And they have formed a new consulting firm to take the same manipulative techniques that they used on the Obama re-election campaign and apply it to corporate interests. It is called Civis, C-I-V-I-S, Civis Analytics, based in Chicago with an office in Washington, bankrolled entirely by Eric Schmidt. And I've never spent a lot of time thinking about Eric Schmidt. I had no idea he was so deeply involved in the Obama political machinery, or that he is now transitioning that mechanism into the corporate sphere. We're going to have to pay more attention to this guy, I guess. Over the weekend, a lot of unrest in Istanbul, and it has spread to other cities in Turkey. It started as a protest over a plan to cut down some trees in an urban park in Istanbul, and I've been there as a tourist. It's a huge city. I think the unofficial population is around 12 million. But it became a vehicle for protest against the repressive government of President, or I guess he's a prime minister, Erdogan. And Erdogan went on television and he said, if they call someone who has served the people a dictator, I have nothing to say. My only concern has been to serve my country. And this is not an Arab Spring, at least not that we can detect so far. But there was a violent crackdown by police with pepper spray, with water cannons. Reports from doctors in Turkey: 1,000 people injured in Istanbul, 700 in Ankara. And, of course, as civil war rages across the border in Syria, the carnage continues in nearby Iraq. Elections are upcoming in border nation Iran. This is a very, very serious time in the Middle East. We'll continue to monitor the situation in Turkey. Last week, we raised questions about the shifting reports from the FBI on how Ibrahim Todashev was killed. Maybe you've heard the story. He's a 27-year-old Chechen American. He was friends with the Tsarnaev brothers, who were fingered for the Boston Marathon bombing. And that's a case riddled with inconsistencies and contradictions, at least in the news accounts and the official narrative offered by the government. We are told, and we only have official government sources to rely on, and most of those cited in the news media are anonymous government sources. And they first said that Todashev attacked the FBI agent with a knife. Then they said, well, there's no knife. And they've modified the story to this, that he was interrogated on a lengthy basis by the FBI agent and two members of the Massachusetts State Patrol. And they apparently convinced him to sign a confession that he was involved with the Tsarnaev brothers in a murder case in Waltham, Massachusetts, about 3 years ago. But now what was a knife or a blade or that he might have been reaching for a gun, has turned into a metal rod that may have come from a lamp or a broomstick. We can't get the story straight. And Connor Friedersdorf, writing online at The Atlantic, has just tried to reconcile the conflicts in the news accounts received so far. He goes to last Thursday's New York Times, quoting an unnamed senior law enforcement official briefed on the matter, and the story shifts a little more. And the story is that Tadashev was writing this confession, and when the FBI agent kind of looked away, Tadashev lifted the table that he was writing on and threw it at the FBI guy, which knocked him down, injured his face, requiring stitches, and that as he was getting up, the FBI agent started firing. Now, we know from the forensic report and Tadashev's father that 6 shots were fired into the frontal torso of Tadashev, and a single shot was fired to the back of his head. Now, you can come up with a lot of different scenarios, but it's very hard to understand why, for example, the FBI agent there with 2 state troopers, presumably armed, was the only one who shot. And so let me read from Friedersdorf's analysis. What really confounds me about this account is the part where Tadashev allegedly ran at the agent with a metal pole that might have been a broomstick. If he was running with a large object in his hands when killed, how is there any doubt about what the object is? Anyone could just look at the dead guy and see what was in his hands, right? Or examine the stuff in the evidence locker, pole or broomstick. This source doesn't know. It's also quite a feat to be shot, struck, knocked backward, and charge again toward a gun, especially for a guy who, according to his friends, was in recovery from leg surgery. And of course, it's odd that this latest story is so different from the previous ones that have leaked out. A knife, a samurai sword, a metal pole, and a broomstick don't seem like objects that would be confused for one another. Finally, he says, this account has a police detective who ostensibly sees the table overturned, sees the FBI agent get injured, sees Tadashev attacking with a pole, sees the injured agent draw and fire his gun as he tries to get up, sees Tadashev knocked back and rushing forward again, but never fires his own weapon. Hard to trust our government these days, isn't it? Well, this will add to it. Because you're about to hear something I have never uttered before. I agree with Justice Antonin Scalia. Wow, that hurt. I need some painkillers right now. The Supremes announced today that police may take DNA samples from people arrested in connection with serious crimes. A 5-4 decision, swing vote once again, Justice Anthony Kennedy, but the people who sided with Scalia were not all his right-wing buddies. This is very interesting. Scalia summarized his dissent from the bench. He accused the majority of an unsuccessful sleight of hand, one that taxes the credulity of the credulous. The point of DNA testing, as it is actually practiced, he said, is to solve cold cases, not to identify the suspect in custody, which is the argument that was made by the majority and in the opinion written by Justice Kennedy. Make no mistake about it, Scalia writes, because of today's decision, your DNA can be taken and entered into a national database if you are ever arrested, rightly or wrongly, and for whatever reason. He's right. And I haven't read the opinion. I don't know all of the underlying details. But I know that if you get entered into the DNA database in California, you cannot get out of it. Even if you are tried and found innocent, you only have to be charged with a crime. And the Supremes say it has to be a serious crime. Don't know what the definition of that is. But it's like the no-fly list. You can get on, but you can't get off. And You know, we've lost a lot of privacy over the last few years. This just seems to take it one step further. Over in the United States Senate in the last week, Democrats have joined forces with Republicans to defeat two issues important to progressives. One was an amendment by New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand to restore $4 billion in food stamp cuts by reducing corporate welfare to a handful of crop insurance companies, mostly based overseas. Only 26 senators voted for it. That's about half of the Democrats in the Senate. But 28 of the Senate Democrats joined with all voting Republicans to defeat this amendment, and we shall now name names. Baucus, Bennett, Cardin, Carper, Coons, Donnelly, Durbin, Feinstein, Franken, yes, Al Franken, Hagan, Harkin, Heinrich, Heitkamp, Johnson, Kane, Klobuchar, Landrieu, Manchin, McCaskill, Mikulski, Nelson of Florida, Pryor, Rockefeller, Shaheen, Stabenow of Michigan, Tester of Montana, Mark Udall, and Warner of Virginia. If one of those senators represents you, I suggest you get on the phone immediately. Tell them that you deplore that they would favor corporate welfare over food stamps for needy Americans. And while the stock market is up, except it took a dive late last Friday, and the housing market appears to be working on another bubble, unemployment is still extremely high. There are many people who have not and will never recover from the 08 recession. And it is so cruel to be cutting food stamps at a time when there are people who desperately need them. And I also want to thank longtime listener and subscriber Andy Drawl. Used to work on Wall Street. He relocated to the San Francisco Peninsula a couple of years ago. And he emailed me to point out that once again, so-called progressive Democratic senators voted against Bernie Sanders' bill, which would merely permit states to require GMO labeling on food products. It's not a requirement at the federal level. It simply allows states to make that determination. And here are some people who we think of as progressives who voted against it. Elizabeth Warren, the new senator from Massachusetts. Al Franken, again. Sherrod Brown of Ohio. Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. And, you know, a lot of this happens and people aren't paying attention to the votes and these folks, our senators, are not held accountable. I hope you'll take a little action and try to change that. And the margin of Democratic control in the Senate just slipped by another vote. As 89-year-old Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey passed away over the weekend. And despite his lengthy illness, they wheeled him into the Capitol to vote on several critical issues recently. And it shows just how much more difficult things will become because Lautenberg's successor will be named by Obama's big fat best friend, Chris Christie, the Republican governor of New Jersey. And I just want to comment briefly because I know we have some listeners in New Jersey or former Jersey residents. Frank Lautenberg was in his second tour of the United States Senate. He had retired. Lautenberg had been retired. And I can't remember if Torricelli was his direct successor or had the other Senate seat from New Jersey. But Bob Torricelli was a slimy Democrat. And he was exposed just as re-election was approaching. And in real New Jersey style, it really afflicts Democrats and Republicans there, The Democrats pulled a maneuver of questionable legality where they inserted Lautenberg's name on the ballot at the very last minute. And so we'll see if the succession under Governor Christie is any cleaner, but it is highly likely that Frank Lautenberg will be replaced by a Republican, and it'll be interesting to see if it's a hardline Tea Party Republican or perhaps a more moderate Republican, as New Jersey has seen in the past. I mentioned earlier in talking about Bradley Manning and the crackdown on leakers that President Obama personally is being fingered as the reason why a journalist from Yemen named Abdulella Haider Shay has been in prison now for quite a while. And in an open letter that was written by Mr. Shay and published in the United States Today, he writes, "It's inaccurate to say the Americans imprisoned me because some of them defended and supported me and opposed my detention. Actually, the only person responsible for kidnapping and detaining me is Barack Obama." Now, Shay gained fame and attention for his interviews with figures associated with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Before his arrest and imprisonment, he uncovered that a December 2009 bombing in the village of Majala in southern Yemen was not a Yemeni airstrike, but was an American sea-based missile strike on a camp that killed dozens of civilians, including 14 women and 21 children. And some speculate that this was the reason that they dispatched Abdul Mutallah, the underwear bomber, to try to blow up that Northwest Airline flight on Christmas Day 2009 as it was landing in Detroit. And so that exposure made him a suspect to the U.S. government. He also got interviews with Anwar al-Awlaki and others, and they locked him up in August of 2010. He was denied a lawyer, kept in solitary for 34 days, and then taken to court. And he was charged a little bit later and sentenced to 5 years in prison for participating in an armed group and having links with Al-Qaeda. Now, shortly after he was convicted, the president of Yemen at the time, Saleh, was on the verge of pardoning him. Then Saleh got a call from Obama. According to the official White House account of the call, February 2, 2011, President Obama expressed concern over the release of Shay, who had been sentenced to 5 years in prison for his association with AQAP. Nearly 2.5 years later, Saleh's successor, an our puppet, whose name is Hadi, said he planned to secure Shay's release. Speaking with reporters just a month ago on May 6, during a meeting at the United Nations, Hadi left listeners with the impression that Shay would be freed before Ramadan, which starts July 8. Now in Yemen, they're walking back from Hadi's assurances, and human rights advocates and those who support the rights of journalists are protesting and protesting loudly. Well, the fine folks at our airports, the TSA, have now informed us that the Michael Chertoff backscatter X-ray machines have been entirely removed from American airports. This is the machine that could identify body parts in fairly explicit ways. And it's been replaced by a machine that, for example, doesn't define a woman's breasts or anyone's genitals. But if it detects something other than, human flesh and bones, it places a little marker over that part of the body on the X-ray image. I don't think Michael Chertoff, the former Bush appointee at Homeland Security, is taking a profit on the machines that they have replaced the backscatter with. But I still decline whenever I can. When I go through the airport, I submit to the pat-down body search, rather than go through the machines. I'm not particularly concerned about the X-rays, but that's the excuse I use. And it's because it's the only option we have at the airport to signal our disapproval that somehow airports are a Bill of Rights-free zone and that to get on a plane we have to give up our constitutional rights. I simply don't buy that. And finally today, I just want to share a comment that I screamed at my television the end of last week. As you may know, I try to watch the PBS television news hour every evening. It is not perfect, and it is disappointing in many ways by the limited range of people that they interview, the very carefully circumscribed subjects that they cover, and their flat-out refusal to bring true progressives onto the show very often. But I was floored. Judy Woodruff was interviewing a man named William Amon. He is a high-ranking official with the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis. And Judy Woodruff led him into a series of comments based on a phony premise that the cause of the economic crash at the end of 2008 was predatory borrowers, people who bought a house and went in way over their heads, and more broadly, that it was consumers who helped bring down the economy. And it's just so frustrating to hear this kind of bullshit. Because sure, there were a handful of people who gamed the system and borrowed too much money and went into foreclosure. But we know that most of the people who took out subprime loans only took them because they were told that's all they could get. Or they were sweet-talked or bamboozled by a sales agent, a mortgage broker, who received a bigger commission for putting them into a volatile subprime loan. And then those subprime loans, some based on lies, they called them liar loans, because the mortgage brokers would encourage people to pump up their incomes or falsify information. It's just going to go into a file, don't worry about it. And those bad mortgages became the toxic mortgage-backed securities that were flipped to Wall Street, falsely rated as AAA when those who rated them knew otherwise. And these kinds of shitty deals, and that's a quote from a Goldman Sachs executive before Carl Levin's banking committee, these shitty deals were allowed to go into the system, and that's what led to the economic collapse. It was not borrowers who brought down the economy. It was greedy lenders and those who manipulated the loan products to try to make money on them 3, 4, or maybe 5 times. Okay, I feel better now. Thanks for listening to our news and comment. Feel free to share this podcast everywhere.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.